Hi, I'm Rachel Sosin, and this is 6 Degrees of Innovation, a podcast that grew out of my natural curiosity and love of innovative solutions to big and little challenges. Each episode, I'll speak with someone who is making an impact in an innovative way. Listen in as we talk about what got them started, what problem they're tackling, and how it's going. I'm back. It turns out, trying to get acclimated into a new job and host a podcast and try to have a life was a lot to juggle. Have you read the findings about the 4-day work week study that took place here last year? No? Maybe you should. Anyway, I'm back and excited to start sharing some more conversations with interesting people who are doing cool things. I love when people are somehow acerbic and warm and fuzzy. I also love when someone sees a solution that bucks the norm and does it anyway, because it just makes sense. Not necessarily setting out to be disruptive, but because the right thing to do happens to be disruptive. Today's guest ticks all those boxes. Gemma Davis is a security behavior and culture change expert and the founder of CultureGem, a company that has built an e-learning platform that accounts for sensory and attention differences. This makes those dreaded induction and annual review trainings much more accessible and, dare I say it, even fun. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Thank you so much for joining me, Gemma. I appreciate it. I am excited to talk to you. And so I think I'd like to start by asking if you could tell me how you came to be, you know, a leader in the InfoSec industry, because I think you sort of ended up there in an interesting way as well.
Yeah. So my dad would call it a portfolio career and that I'm never going to achieve anything. So I guess like I am not an academic person. So I kind of, I learn things by doing. And so going through my life, I would have like basic jobs, and then there would be an opportunity to learn something new for various reasons, and I'd always be putting my hand up and saying like, oh, I'll learn that. So that kind of took me on an evolving path of careerness, I guess. So I've done some interesting stuff. So I used to be a support worker for adults with learning difficulties, where I would teach them life skills, which was the best yet most challenging thing that I've ever done. And the reason it wasn't the best in the moment, but right now, like, I could wander out into the town that I live in and see one of these people that were in my class, and they don't remember me at all, but they are doing something that I taught them how to do like maybe 10 years ago. So that kind of led me on a path of how people's minds work. And then I ended up working in direct response marketing, pure chance, because I kind of just kept putting my hand up and saying, I'll learn that. And then made that my career. So in direct response marketing, I guess I was quite good at it, influencing people to do what I wanted them to do. And that could be like buying shoes or donating money or whatever it is that I wanted them to do. I call it my last real job. So I was employed, and that was in marketing, and I got made redundant, and I was on holiday when I got made redundant. I had like 10 minutes of meltdown of like, oh my God, what am I going to do? But in the resort I was staying in was an all-you-can-eat cake bar. So I just obviously went to the all-you-can-eat cake bar after about 10 minutes, filled my face with cake, and then was like, I'm actually not going to get another job. I'm good at what I do. I'm going to set up on my own and go out into the world and see if I can make this work. So I set up a little business, and my first client was the Open Web Application Security Project, who booked me for a conference to help them out with this, the marketing and event management of this conference. What then happened was I was in a room with like 200 CISOs from around the world, and they were talking security at me, and I had no idea what they were talking about, because I was there to do the, like, making sure the food arrived at the same time, at the right time, and like, you know, everyone's dietary requirements have been met, and is the AV working, and have we done the right graphics, and all that kind of stuff. So that was a weird thing, because what that I not only was I in a room with 200 CISOs, I lived with 200 CISOs for like 10 days. And I don't think anybody can ever say that that's what they did as a non-security person. So at the end of this 10 days, I was like, I've got Stockholm syndrome. Like, I don't know how I'm going to wake up and not listen to security nonsense all the time. So I was talking to this guy and said, it's going to be really weird doing this. And he was like, hey, I'm setting up a team. Come join me, like come and offer your services. And I was like, I don't know anything about security, I'm a marketing person. And he convinced me that it was transferable. And as I said, I've just gone through my life putting my hand up going, yeah, I'll learn that, that'll be fun. And just taking every opportunity that comes my way and running with it. So off I went and ended up being a security person. So I kind of got, I didn't really care that much about security when that first started, but I got really excited about, well, I got really angry to start off with and was like, this is terrible. I'm a customer. I am a person who has data, which I don't think a lot of people consider that they are a person who is made up of various data chunks. But I got really mad about how companies were treating my data personality. And so I was like, I need to fix this. This is terrible. So it kind of dawned on me that I could use my direct response marketing skills to influence secure behavior as opposed to getting you to buy shoes. So it's like the absolute opposite of like, here, buy these shoes, click on this advert. And then I'm like, don't click on the things. The shoes are bad. So yeah, I've used basically everything that I've learned throughout my life to get to where I am right now, which is I specialize in secure behavior, culture change activities. And that kind of led me into building like a product that is an e-learning compliance tool that basically you choose how you're going to learn and in which, what color. And so, yeah, that's my story.
So before we get to Culture Gem and the e-learning tool, can you talk a little bit more about data personality and like that moment when you were angry and what that means? And so what was, because I think I understand. I know that I can go into my Google settings and I can tell that Google thinks I'm like in my 60s because of how much I really like to look at gardening and cats and recipes and, you know, whatever. So I assume that is what you mean about data personality, although certainly open to being wrong on that. And then what do you mean about about culture or about behavior change?
Okay. So yeah, you're kind of right. And you're lucky that Google only thinks you're 60, because I don't know what age Google thinks I am. I get anti-aging products and incontinence pads. So I don't know what my browsing history is telling Google, but I clearly I'm way above the 60s. Yeah. So there's an element of, yeah, what does your profile look like? What is your browsing habits? And what does that mean about the assumptions that are made of you? But actually, like, your data profile could be that you've got like PayPal,
got it,
which is a data profile. So it's any online active, well, it's not necessarily even online, like your medical records are a data profile about you. And so I remember thinking back way before I was in the security space, like, no one's going to steal my identity because they're just going to bring it back. It's like literally not worth anything. But actually, your data profile is worth something. So I could be wrong on the exact numbers these days, but like, your PayPal credentials will be on sale on the dark web for $8. And that's not once and done. That's $8 to anyone who wants to buy it. So there's big money in information about you. Whether that's used for nefarious things like stealing your credentials and logging in and trying to gain access to more information or money about you, into causing problems. But even as a data profile to be advertised to, so you're saying like there is a profile on you in Google and they think you're 60, that information is used. And is worth something to a bidder. So like the Facebook advertising side of things, I know what kind of cheese you like based on your profile. And I could go into that for a really long time, but there's like it's an interesting thing. So I'll just give you a quick example. There is a curly fries page on Facebook. It's been around for forever. The guy who created the curly fries page is of above average intelligence. So then he then invited all of his friends to like the curly fries page, and then they did. So if you like the curly fries page, the Facebook algorithm thinks that you are of above average intelligence, so it profiles you in a certain way. So because you like that page, you may not see curly fries, but you're going to see something maybe around investment banking because you like the curly fries page. And so that's a data profile on you that you've got no concept about, and you couldn't even unpick the weird things that make you the data profile that you are, like curly fries.
I don't know if my profile were really wrong for some reason. Is there a way for me to correct it? Or does it even really matter, I guess, in the sense that, like, if it's wrong, does that just mean that then the advertising is less relevant to me? Sort of leaving aside the nefarious side of it for the moment.
Absolutely means the advertising is less relevant, hence why I see incontinence pads, which I am not in my shopping basket. But actually, I was having this conversation with someone at the InfoSec conference this week, because they were saying, why do I just see all of this in my Instagram feed? And it's that you've interacted with something, possibly accidentally, that means that you have been profiled in a certain way. And they were asking me, how do I reset that? And I don't know what the answer is, because I would love to not see Tenor Lady in my feeds. But I mean, you could go down the route of like clearing your cache or cookies. Like, cookies are the thing that collect, follow you around the internet and collect mm-hmm. data on you. So if you clear like your cookies and don't accept cookies, then potentially your profile, it still exists, and you are still something, you are a commodity to the people that want to buy your data. But yeah, you'll just see less relevant things to you. So actually, I don't know, is cookies a good thing or a bad thing? I don't want to be advertised to. So yeah, I don't, if I clear my cookie browsing history, cache, all that kind of stuff, I probably am not going to see Tenor Lady anymore. But I don't know. I genuinely don't know what the answer is.
Okay. And then question more related to the nefarious side, aside from, because I too have always said like, well, whatever, they can steal my identity. You know, I track things well enough that I will notice and I will call my bank and, you know, I'm not worried, which I know is the wrong attitude to take, but, you know, I've just always sort of felt a little ambivalent about it. Like, that is the price we pay for putting our whole world into the internet. But what are the nefarious things that someone can do with my identity or with my data, aside from, you know, buying things on my credit? Like, what is the, I guess maybe that's part of why I've always felt a little ambivalent, is buying things on my identity feels like a pain, but not difficult to undo. So what are the things that, what are the other types of things that my data could be used for?
Yeah, I think this is something that we just do not talk about enough in the world. Because I think, like, when we're hacked or when there's some sort of incident that affects us, we don't actually talk about it because there's an element of shame or a taboo mm-hmm. around, like, I am a victim of this. And I don't view myself as a victim of anything. So it's hard, that mindset. But I do like to share horror stories. I know someone who got a prescription from the doctors, from the GP surgery. And in the UK, when you get a prescription, there's like a green part and a white part. The green part goes to the pharmacist, and then they give you the pills that are on there. And the white part is sometimes used, but basically it contains a bit of personal information around you. Things like your name, your date of birth, your address, and your national health number. Now, this was a while ago, and they have changed the prescription documents since then. So it's probably a little bit less risky these days than it was then. But he had this white piece of paper. He's got his prescription. He threw the white piece of paper in the bin outside the pharmacy. Thought everything was fine. Nothing weird going on until he had like a raging tooth infection. Went to the dentist, and they were like, you're not registered here. And so he then had to go to the hospital to go for emergency dental treatment. And they were like, who are you? We don't know who you are. Like, you don't exist here in this location. So he was like, what's going on? Tried to make an appointment with the GP, was no longer registered at that GP. So he was like, this is weird. Didn't put anything together about the whole situation. So a couple of weeks later, the police knocked on his door, and they were like, hey, you've been hiring cars and not returning them. So we've come in to take you in for the bad things that you're doing. You're like stealing cars. Now, thankfully, what they had was a driving license picture of the assailant that they were looking for, and they were a different race. So he was like, that's not me. And they were like, oh, no, well, we can see that's not you. Where's your ID? And kind of proved that he was who he was supposed to be. So basically what happened was, that was like the general upshot of the effects that had on that individual. But what had happened was somebody had got access to that document that had national health number, address, name, date of birth. That was enough information for them to do what they did. They then took that information and registered with a GP in another town, which then cancels your registration somewhere else, so then you can't access medical care. What they got from that was then a letter on official headed NHS paper that says this person is registered at this GP surgery. They then took that information and applied for a driving license. So then they got a driving license in this guy's name, but changed the address and what have you, and then started to commit crimes with his cloned identity. Now, that could have been a hell of a lot worse had he had the same face or even looked remotely similar to that guy. But when you can't access healthcare and you have got the police knocking on your door and you're late for work and you have to call your boss and say, I can't come in, the police are here and they're investigating me for car theft, that has an impact on your life. And then the recovery period from that scenario of then trying to access healthcare and prove that you are the person that's entitled to that healthcare, or like getting that driving license cancelled and try and regain control over your own identity, that's not something that the average person knows how to do. And there's very limited advice on how you recover from that situation. Things are getting better and there are advice lines out there that will help you. But yeah, it's not a case of they can steal my identity, everything's fine. It genuinely does have an impact on your well-being, your access to healthcare, your access to financial bits and pieces.
Wow. That's okay. Well, now I feel bad for being so ambivalent about it.
We all are. Until you know, you don't know. Yeah. Right? And I think that's a big problem in the world, is that we don't know we're a target because nobody's talking about it. And if we are talking about it, we're talking about it in such a boring way that people don't really care. They're like, oh, this is boring nonsense again. Yeah. Like, I see TV adverts all the time for like VPNs or internet security products. And they're supposed to be targeted to average people. And I just think the average person doesn't know what a VPN is. So you're like, you need to convert them before you try and sell this. But you know, ooh, buy this VPN, it's going to protect you from stuff that you don't think is a threat to you, is the wrong approach.
So I want to pivot back to, because you had just started talking about Culture Gem and the e-learning platform. And I would love to talk more about that, because I think this story is so fascinating, particularly in the sense that you saw a problem with a, maybe not an easy solution, but certainly a kind of obvious solution, and said, well, let's do it. And now, as far as I know, you're the only one doing it. And so, yeah, could you tell me more about the e-learning platform and how you managed to build something that is so inclusive and so proactively inclusive?
So I guess there was the journey, and I'm going to be completely honest. I didn't necessarily set out on the inclusivity journey when I started this project. I was having a conversation with someone and they were like, how do you scale you? So my day job, as I said, is security, behavior and culture, change activities. And when there's only one of you and you're doing that all the time, your brain gets a little bit squishy. And so that was a question that I went away to ponder and thought, I don't know how to productize me. So I then was like, hey, actually, a lot of what I do is around the terrible e-learning market that's out there for compliance training. So that's like the stuff when you join a company in the first day and they're like, hey, take your e-learning, just a horrible experience. And then a year later, you have to do it again. So you spend 20 minutes clicking through stuff and you don't pay any attention. You don't know that you're a target and you don't know about VPNs because you just have gamed the system. So I set out on a journey to try and fix what I knew at the time to be the problems with the good compliance e-learning side of things. And one of those problems is to do compliance well, you have to buy multiple products. So you maybe have like three or four different learning systems to do the stuff good. And a lot of the time when you go on a journey to find one of these things, the sales teams will tell you that their system does stuff that it actually doesn't. And they'll try and sell you their development roadmap and go, yeah, no, like it meets all of your needs. And I experienced that because I've got really good relationships from the consultancy side of things with most of the e-learning providers in the compliance space. So I was like, okay, right, how do I then build something where all compliance is in one place and actually I'm not lying, it does everything that I know that my customers needed to do from the consultancy side of the business. And I kind of had an idea that I wanted to look at the different learning styles, because back when I was a support worker, I would do individual learning plans for my group, and my class size was 6, and it was hard. It was really hard because there were things that I couldn't understand. I couldn't plan for. Mm-hmm. So I think you and I were talking the other day, and like one of the things that I was teaching my class to do was use a keyboard. And so when you ask them to type their name, like a keyboard layout, everything's capitalized unless you've got a special keyboard. So you automatically type the first letter of your name and then a lowercase letter comes up on the screen because you have to do something to make that uppercase. Yeah, the keyboard is all in uppercase, so that then there's a disconnect. And then now write the rest of your name, which is in lowercase, but there are no lowercase letters. But as you type, they come out lowercase. And that was something that I never even considered was a problem until I was in my class with my students. And I was like, I don't even know how to explain this. Like, it was a wild card that I hadn't even been expecting. So I kind of, from that side of things, knew that everybody learns differently. As I said earlier, I'm not an academic, I'm not book smart. I learn by doing things and breaking stuff and playing around and volunteering for every opportunity for growth that is put in front of me. So I knew that my brain didn't work the same. And I grew up in a house where everybody was academic. So they were like, what is wrong with you? And didn't get me at all. So I knew that I've always known that my brain works differently to everybody else's that has been around me. So I kind of was looking at that learning style side of things very early on. But obviously, when you build a product, you need a product development team. So I hired a product development team. And I hadn't even considered like the demographic makeup of an organization. So I hired this team and they were all neurodivergent in their own way. So I had like ADHD, autism, dyslexia, just various things. And as an inclusive employer, I then wanted to make sure that they had the right learning environment, the right environment for them to succeed in their job. So then that meant that I had to make changes to the way that we worked. So, for example, I had one guy who needed like blue paper, someone who needed yellow paper, and someone who needed pink paper. And that doesn't seem like a big problem, but I can buy a notepad for like £1. If I buy a yellow notepad, that's like a tenner. Mm-hmm. And it's half the size. So it doesn't last as long. And so then it kind of got me onto this, how do I make that not so expensive and prohibitive for people to make allowances for their staff while I'm building this e-learning product? And also, I cannot be the only organization that has to do this because of the team that I've hired. So we basically, my neurodivergent team built a product that is for neurodivergence. and it does all of the compliance in one place, which is a problem that I see in the market, and it solves all of the problems that I see in the market in other ways. But actually, it looks at the learner first. So if you consider when you, like I say, when you start a new job and you go there on your first day and you do your horrible e-learning stuff, that has been selected by someone based on their bias, based on how they learn or how much money they've got or the look and feel that they're going for, without any consideration to the workforce that are going to use it. So the tool that we built gives the learner the chance to select how they want to learn, in which voice and in which color, and covers all of the compliance in one place and meets the needs of like the decision makers in terms of administration, reporting, inside, that side of things. You're right. I don't know anyone who's doing this. I'm sure somebody will, with loads of money, will come in and swipe the idea at some point, but not at this moment. But yeah, so like I said, it was a journey. I started off trying to solve one problem, and then the problem just kept evolving. And so we were like, yeah, let's solve that one. Let's solve this. Let's solve that. And we've got a whole queue of things that we've seen out in the world that we're like, that's horrible. That's a horrible experience for me, for you, for anyone. So we need to work out how to solve those problems. And we'll keep doing that, keep doing the research into how that's the best thing for people. That's kind of the journey.
I think it's really fascinating. And the very first time we talked, you walked me through sort of all the different ways that someone could go through a compliance training, and particularly as someone who has just recently started a new job and had to do a ton of compliance trainings. I don't know that had I not spoken to you, I would have thought about it. You know, they're boring, but that just is. But they make sense to me because I guess I am relatively close to the bell curve in terms of the way brains work. And so I just wouldn't have given it a ton of thought. And I imagine that's also the position that a lot of the people who are purchasing these products are sitting in as well. And so, but having had that conversation with you right before starting this job and going through these trainings, I suddenly was watching all of this with a completely new lens. And I find it really fascinating just even thinking about the difference. I remember when you gave me a tour, you can, even within the different options for people to listen to the material, there are different methods. And I just keep thinking about how huge that must be for someone who needs to, who learns best by listening, but not all speaking, I guess, is the same. You know, for some people, you may want to listen to something that sounds very dry, like a teacher at a board. Sorry, teachers, but you know, something very like dry and kind of monotone. Or you might want to listen to something that sounds much more conversational, even if the content is covering the same material. And so, what I really keep thinking about as going through my own induction is how great it is to have so many options. Even where you don't even necessarily need to know this is the kind of learning I would like to do, because the platform is set up so that you log in and you see, I think you had 8 different methods of going through a compliance training. You know, it gives someone like me the chance to kind of play around and say like, I wonder if I would prefer to read or if I would prefer to watch someone speaking and listen to them, or if I would prefer, my favorite one that you had that I thought was so cool was almost like a game. So kind of the gamification, and you have to find all of the content throughout the looked like an escape room. And so where I think that this, I love that you have built something that is inclusive, but I think what I love even more is that it doesn't necessarily have to be billed as inclusive. Like this is something that like, I guess, how am I trying to say this? A person doesn't necessarily need to know that they could benefit from an accommodation to benefit from the platform, because they can find something just by experimenting.
Yeah, and we all have a preference. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the is the dress blue or black or white and gold? I don't know if you remember this from years ago, right? And everybody was debating this, and that has just literally popped into my head as this is the reason why, right? Because there is absolutely no rhyme or reason behind why you see that dress in different colors, or the whole which word do you hear? Things that go around, like, what are they saying? Are they saying this or that? But that's based on how your brain is processing things. Now, I could see the dress in white and gold and blue or black, depending on the room that I was in. So they're like all the stimulus around me, and we're surrounded by stimulus all the time. Now, the reason that the voices, like, what word do you hear, affects people differently and they hear different things is because of the frequency of the voice. Now, there are some people who I make a joke of this and say, like, my dad will always listen. He'll set his sat nav to a male voice because he doesn't want to listen to a woman because he perceives the woman is nagging at him. But actually, like, that's the jokey side of it. It's the frequency of the voice. And some people, like, actually cannot even hear a female voice. Or they have a reaction to that because of the frequency, and it's not necessarily that they perceive them to be nagging or otherwise. Now, if we go back to what I was saying around the notepads and things like that, what me having to buy notepads for my staff, exactly what you were saying is they had to know that they needed that, right? They had to know that, oh, I need blue paper. They had to tell me I need blue paper. So that forces them to make some kind of admission about their own self and how that they achieve things, which is uncomfortable. Like, we all do things because we have the social anxiety of not doing it. Like, my neighbors mow their lawn, I mow my lawn. I don't want to be the house with the lawn that's not mowed. So we all do weird things, and we don't want to feel the pressure of failing because we haven't done the weird thing. So what traditional accessibility controls do is force the learner to have to put their hand up and say, I need something, whether it's blue paper or a screen reader or a filter on their screen or whatever it is. It forces you to know what you need in the moment and ask for it. And that may or may not be a comfortable thing. Mm-hmm. You and I have talked about, like, the differences between, like, obnoxious Americanism and the British way of doing things. And British people won't kind of be aggressively, like, we're kind of passive aggressive and we don't like to cause a scene. So there can be, I don't know, a cat in your food and you're like, oh, I'll just eat round the cat because you don't want to cause a scene. That is life, right? We just hope that things are going to be better, but we don't want to confront it because that's a horrible situation. So yeah, like, if you kind of need something that you know you need because you have some kind of diagnosis, then you have to put your hand up and say, I need that, and that's uncomfortable. But on the other side of things, I don't even know what the percentage of undiagnosed, diagnosed neurodivergence is. I'm weird. I don't have a diagnosis. I need things to be done in a certain way. I get very agitated if things are not done in a certain way, and I can't stand people breathing near me, and there's just like a whole thing about me, but I'm not diagnosed with anything. But I learn in a very different way to every one of myself. So I don't know if we went through this when I was giving you a bit of a demo, but I listen to everything in 2x speed, and I actually don't really care what voice I listen to as long as it's fast. If I don't listen to something quickly, then it leaves my brain time to wander off down a corridor of crazy that I cannot regain control of, as you know, because I go off on tangents all the time. So yeah, the whole, it's inclusive. I wouldn't say it's for neurodivergence because it gives everyone the opportunity to learn about their own brain. And my brain is a wonderful place that I'm learning about all the time. And there are so many interesting things, and I love talking to people about how their brain processes because it's very different from the chaos that's going on in my head.
I especially because, you know, like you said, it's not something that is built with inclusion as the goal. It is built with solving a problem as the goal and doing that in an inclusive way, because why wouldn't you? And you also talked about how you and your team sort of have a whole list of things of where else this type of platform could be beneficial. And maybe that's not something you can talk about because it's in development. I don't know. But how does Culture Gem become the normal way of training, and what does it extend to beyond InfoSec and compliance? Or is that, you know, like, is that a different part of your work and, you know, would become a totally different platform? I don't know.
No, I absolutely would love for this to be the norm, which is why I'm really okay with talking about it. People keep saying to me, like, what if your competitors just run with it and you know, they've got bigger budgets and bigger development teams? And actually, what's really sad about that is that I don't even think they know it's a problem that they should be focusing on. So I don't think that they're necessarily going to be taking over the world with it. And so that kind of leaves me to try and take over the world and wave the inclusivity flag and keep talking about stuff and hoping that it sticks. And actually, from my experiences, it is. Every time I talk to someone, they're like, oh my God, I know someone who would benefit from that. Now, what's great about what we did is the possibilities are endless. Mm-hmm. So whilst we built it for compliance, actually it could work really good in mainstream education. It would absolutely fit into that world. And then what we don't have is a disengaged new generation of people who have been failed by the terrible education system in every country, where some bloke in a suit says, this is how we're going to do it. And so they blindly follow that path of knowledge retention is the thing that needs to be done. Now, the education system absolutely failed me because I was not an academic learner, and I actively remember giving up on learning. And I was 8 years old. But what I then found as I went through my life is I love learning, absolutely love learning, but in a way that works for me. So by creating something that people can learn in a way that works for them, hopefully I am doing some good in the world. And like you say, the possibilities are endless, and it works. We just need to create the content and put it into the template, and it just all happens in a lovely way. Yeah, I'm going to keep waving the flag and talking to people and hope that they wave the flag, and they don't necessarily have to come and be my best friend, but please do wave the flag and try and do the right thing. But it doesn't stop there. I think I wrote a piece recently about inclusivity and inductions and how an induction process is actually a really horrible thing for everyone. And we all know that because we've been through it. So the first day when you start a new job, or whenever you get shoehorned into the induction process, the new joiner process, they're poor experiences because they're based on someone's bias, either conscious or unconscious bias, or it's based on the budget that someone has. And they're like, oh, we're going to streamline and we're going to smash all this together and like scale, and it's going to be a repeatable great thing. Actually, what that does is it doesn't work for everybody, and it makes everyone really uncomfortable. And it's horrible. It's just, I make it my business to go to induction so that I can try and improve that that for other people. But I wrote about like my five typical induction experiences, all of which are not inclusive. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I don't know about you, but when I start a new job, I am terrified I'm going to get fired, and they're going to see that I'm a massive imposter. And they're going to be like, why did we take this? Like,
yes.
How did she blind us so much in the interview that now we're in this situation and we have to try and get her out? So I'm already hyper stressed in the situation, and I'm hyper stimulated because I have to remember so much stuff. Like, where's the toilet? Where, like, who are these people? What's your name? And I'm terrible with names. And so, yeah, it's just a horrible experience. There'll be too much going on, too many things to remember, and you already feel like you don't belong there and you don't deserve to be there, and you have to remember too much stuff. So I'm just going to keep banging on about how these are horrible experiences for everyone until we can change the way things are done.
I think all of that makes so much sense to me. And I feel like we could continue talking about all of this. And I realize I'm not sure that I really asked enough questions about the culture, about the security behavior culture work, which I think is also really interesting and important. And so before we round out, is there anything, if you wanted to give sort of like a two sentence, what people need to know or where they can find more about that side of your work, what would you say?
So I do something called soggy writing, where I get really mad about stuff and then I blog about it. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's soggy is I as we all do, play out all of the best arguments that I never had in my head while I'm in the shower. Mm-hmm. And so I get really irritated about something and I jump out of the shower and I wrap a towel around me and I blog. And so I guess if you're interested in all of my thoughts and feelings around inclusivity, security behavior, culture change stuff, and how you can do things better, then look up InfoSec Gem. So it's I can spell it out if that helps. It's InfoSecJem. And you'll find my Twitter, LinkedIn, my Medium, about all the things that I'm angry about in the world.
Fantastic. And I will make sure to put that in the show notes too. But yes, because I feel like I'm glad that we talked about the e-learning platform, because I feel like there's the innovation of simply doing the right thing, I think, was really what I wanted to focus on. But I want people to know where they can find out more about security behavior culture and making better choices. I do want to ask you the question that I ask everybody who is on the podcast. It is the whole reason for the name of the show, which is, could you tell me someone or an organization that is doing something that you find really innovative and exciting and that you think people should be paying attention to?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm probably going to explain why before I name them, so that the mic drop is on their name, and then they'll love me forever. But my day job, away from the product side of things and the e-learning, is, like I said, I'm a security behavior culture change person. And so I try and get people to change their viewpoint on how to be secure and really care about that kind of stuff, which is the challenge. And as we were talking about the mandatory e-learning, where you spend like your first couple of days doing some horrible stuff and then you do that again in a year. The reason that that doesn't work and doesn't actually teach you anything is because our brains have a really short interest in things. So from the marketing perspective, if you've not engaged someone in 3 seconds, then you've missed out and you've just sat for 20 minutes listening, like reading e-learning nonsense. That's more than 3 seconds. It's gone. Like we have busy brains. So the true way to encourage behavioral changes is through something called nudges, which is in the moment, hey, don't do that. It's like almost like the angel on your shoulder that's going, hey, like don't cross the road now, the green man's not there, or what, and forget all the devil that's telling you to buy the shoes. So to actually change behaviors, you need to kind of catch someone in a timely fashion in the moment, where they might be doing something like not connecting to the VPN, or they're like clicking on stuff or whatever it is that they're doing that's a risky behavior. And so the company that I think are doing something really cool and innovative in that space is a company called Red Flags. And quite often people say to me, is your product the best thing out there for security awareness? And I say, absolutely not. Red Flags is the best. Because what it does is it catches you in the moment. So it's real-time security awareness. The guy who runs the company is Tim Ward, and he has got loads of interesting things around the psychology of why we do things. So he would be great for you to talk to, Rachel. But absolutely is the right thing to be doing. And I don't know anyone else who's doing the same sort of stuff that he's doing. And he's basing it around the psychology of why we do the crazy things that we do. We quite often have conversations, me and Tim, where like I pass people his way, he passes people my way, and if someone says, oh, what's the best accessibility thing, he says, oh, go to Gemma does the best in terms of accessibility. And when people say what's the best security awareness, I'm like, go to Tim, like he is smashing it. And I would love, we keep like flirting with the idea of smushing our products together, because it would be great, absolutely great. But I don't, like, that we have to work out the technology and how we're going to fund that. But yeah, he genuinely is doing some really cool stuff.
That's fantastic. And I mean, I think that makes so much sense. Like, we know that nudging works with all sorts of other things. Like, you know, you create nudges for yourself if you want to build a habit. You create nudges for yourself if you want to, like, learn a new skill. So, and we know that frequency matters in other elements of, like, people development and training, you know. So there's, you know, most people have moved away from annual reviews and are doing them more in the moment, or doing them on a more regular basis, or more at least with more frequency. And so it's interesting that when it comes to things like compliance, we still follow this, you know, you do it once a year model. So that I think that's, it's nice to see people thinking this, if we don't do this anywhere else in our life, we shouldn't do it this way here, where something, where the stakes are really high.
Definitely.
So thank you for doing this with me. I really appreciate it. And it's always such a pleasure to talk to you about all of the things that are inside your head.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining me for this conversation. And if you find yourself in need of security consulting or just a really fun conversation, check out culturegem.co.uk. You can find it in the show notes. You can also find the link to her Soggy blogging and other places to find Gemma online. And I can confirm that even if you currently have some less than stellar security behaviors, Gemma will be kind. So don't hesitate to contact her. Big, huge thanks to Gemma Davis, my guest today. Also, thank you to you for listening. Please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, and maybe one day I'll be the next Sarah Koenig. If you know someone who would be a great guest, or if you'd like to be on the show yourself, please email me at rachel@sixdegreesstrategy.co or send me a message on LinkedIn. The podcast theme music is Strangers in the Night by Vocalista, downloaded from Upbeat.io.
It's I was talking to a friend about this because when I had the realization, because I'm constantly having realizations about what my brain's up to, and I said to her I have this phobia of my own name, and she was like, yeah, me too. And I don't actually know that many people, but actually it turns out I know two people who have a phobia of their own name. But the reason that she has this fear of her own name is her imposter syndrome. So she said to me, when people say my name, it's followed by "Can you?" And then she's like, no, I can't. No, I am not capable of doing that. And actually, she is very capable and quite successful in her career. But yeah, immediately someone says her name and she's like, oh my God, I'm going to fail. So it's an interesting thing. We're all weird and wonderful beings.
Yeah, it's fascinating, the connections that our brain makes for us, you know.
Sometimes not helpful, but true. Yes, very interesting.
That we could save for another podcast on the ways in which our brain helps and hurts us.
Sign me up.